The philosophic ideal of sane equilibrium would preclude it, whilst its exhortation to self-improvement would oppose it. This ideal offers a fuller, better balanced view. It conquers desires but refuses to make a fetish of discomfort. But it warns man that life holds finer, more vital and more durable things. If he persists in making a monomania of possessions and in becoming obsessed by position, he will miss those finer things. Evil begins only when he permits them to stupefy his mind, when he lets them obstruct the inner spiritual purpose of his life on earth. Buddha may have gone to extremes when he taught that even all the pleasant material things of life were, if considered against their background and consequences, really unpleasant and hence to be shunned. Certainly we must simplify life at some point and surrender it if we are ever to have peace, and certainly too when the search after possessions becomes never-ending, unbalanced, or unethically carried on, it is no longer valid. It is much the same with the taste for healthy pleasure, the urge for amusing relaxation and the desire for light entertainment. They are natural and right. It is not wrong to attend to these human needs. Philosophy, unlike extreme asceticism, does not scorn them and, unlike extreme materialism, does not overrate them. What harm is there in them so long as they are regarded as being mere accessories and not the principal end of life, minor essentials and not the major ones? Man needs them when he lacks the philosophical means of keeping his sanity and balance. It is only when they are overdone or oversought, when they become narcotics to relieve him of the trouble of reflection about life, when they divert his attention from the tragedies and sorrows which should prompt such reflection, that they become dangerous and lead to the very insanity and unbalance against which they ought to guard him. When this happens, desire rages in the heart of the self-indulgent sybarite and disharmony spoils his outer existence. The only way of escape he knows then is to add still more to the fast-burning heap of pleasures. They may push him into sheer vice and harmful folly. When too high a value is set upon pleasure, the inner retribution is inescapable. Happiness will last only as long as the pleasure lasts. The hedonists who spend their affections upon vanishing things alone, hardly conscious of the inner desolation of the fatuous aimlessness of their guilt and lacquered lives, do not realize that the leisure which might be devoted not only to getting necessary relaxation and amusement but also to fulfilling the purpose of incarnation and gaining a little understanding, discipline and peace, is literally wasted away in a quest of idle or sensual enjoyment. But the heaviest retribution comes when the supreme reality is regarded as the supreme triviality. The agony of a world hurled into the chaos of a great war was not remote from such a retribution. For many men and women, before it broke out, the values of a higher purpose to life might as well have been non-existent. They could not believe in a mortal mind, which is perfectly credible, but they did believe in perishable matter, which is metaphysically incredible. They did not understand that in holding to the reality of matter they were holding to the most illusory of man's conceptions. Consequently, they swung their senses of admiration before worthless idols. Such a self-deceptive outlook could only end in dangerous and painful disillusionment. There was a grinning skeleton at such feasting, sarcastically shaking his bony hands in warning. The dark sorrows which life may present us can and should be met with a quiet confidence in the power of the soul to conquer them either psychologically or practically or both. But this power must be felt for, found, trusted and obeyed. If we keep our thought wise and good and brave, it will shield us, always inwardly and mayhap outwardly, from life's sharpest arrows. And this is true whether they are shot at us by harsh fate or by human malice. Even in the darkest situations we often hope for the best. This is really our faintly echoing comprehension of the higher self's message, that its bliss, and therefore our best, forever awaits us. There is a paradox here. We begin the quest of inner happiness when we feel the deep melancholy of discovering the transiency and limitation that underlie all life's beauty and pleasure. We finish it when we discover the deep joy of the soul's everlasting loveliness that underlies the melancholy itself. We suffer today only that we shall be happy tomorrow. The overself's tranquil smile must be earned by fighting a way through the valley of fallen tears. Our deepest wisdom confers the only lasting serenity, yet is born amidst cruelest agony. The most evolved individual in any community is also the happiest one. He has renounced past attitudes and retreated from the ego, and all has come right in the end. Yet, if the secret chronicle of his bygone births could be read, its great length would inevitably single him out as having passed through a full experience of anguish. All the distresses which made their valuable contribution to the development of consciousness and the expansion of intelligence were by nature's mercy utterly obliterated from memory in the end. When the estranged ego shattered its chain, renounced its isolation and returned to its holy parent, secreted within and behind its own self, it found that it was hitherto taught by suffering only that it may henceforth be taught by bliss. Chapter 8. The evil in our time. The events of recent decades provide nothing more or less than a visible commentary on the messages it was the privilege of inspired prophets like Jesus, Krishna and Buddha to deliver. The unprecedented times through which we have lived merely prove by terrible facts what such men preached by opened lips. They prove that the religious unfaith and materialistic trend of a whole generation, the hard skepticism which has degraded their values and dragged down their instincts, afford too insecure a basis for human living. Materialism, by which is meant here not merely the openly confessed and crudely obvious doctrine which goes under this name but also its unconscious and disguised form, sir, has been the bane of our time. The total impression of all the forms it has taken are, and they are to be found in the scientific, political, educational, literary, artistic, ecclesiastic and legal spheres, all, Zohar is a ghastly one. The end of it all is the terrifying figure and the typhoon destructiveness of the atom bomb. It is the natural consequence of belief in the final supremacy of intellectual thinking when pushed to its logical extreme and unbalanced by spiritual intuition. In war, human evil always appears in its worst form and its effects in their most widespread form. With the discovery of the atom bomb, the pathway leading to a large part of civilization's utter self-destruction is now wide open. Nothing in history is comparable to this terrible situation. It is not enough to understand the tragic as well as historic significance of these world-shaking events. We must also understand their underlying religious, metaphysical and philosophical significance. And, as mentioned earlier, this cannot be done adequately unless we let the light of doctrines like the inevitability of spiritual evolution and the factuality of the law of recompense shine down upon them. For without them, it is too taxing to explain why society today is as it is. The psychological situation which has been created by the crisis and the war, and which expresses itself in the tragic physical situation, can be adequately understood only by the light of these and other related truths. Mankind's own wrong thoughts and emotions, bad passions and deeds, must share the responsibility. Its civilization has indeed received the rewards of a short-sighted selfishness, for it has seen so many of the material things it strove to obtain, as well as the ideals it strove to realize, crumble away in its hands. Most people assume that good alone has the right to be active on earth. Therefore, the presence of so much that is evil perplexes their minds. It seems that such evil is too abundant and too continuous to fit smoothly into a divinely ordered scheme. The crime and violence of recent times, the horror and shock of recent history, have pushed this question of evil into the thinking of many persons who formerly ignored it. A generation which has heard wicked propaganda, witnessed wicked atrocities and watched unscrupulous moves towards world domination would be very soft-brained if it does not conclude that some malignant influence is at work in human affairs and that some malignant forces are manifesting their disturbing activities in its midst. The existence of no less than the power of evil has forced itself so plainly and so savagely and so insistently on their notice in recent times that those who, at the bidding of extravagantly optimistic theories, previously shut their eyes to it, have perforce had to open them and recognize it. Such a belated and bewildered act is painful. The materialistic view of evil regarded it as a byproduct of physical environments and temporary circumstances, to be set right by the mere setting right of those physical things. But the type of evil which is so prevalent in our own times, glorifies brutality for its own sake, justifies oppression for the oppressor's sake, pedestals greed, ridicules religion and derides conscience, as much for the pleasure it gets from these activities as for the rewards. The men who practice it love it as intensely as saints love God. It can no longer be reasonably maintained, as the dialectic and rationalist materialists have hitherto maintained, that external circumstances are alone sufficient to account for the unpleasant character of such noxious creatures. On the contrary, it is evident that the wrong of human conduct arises because evil is a real element in human beings, independent of human environment and circumstance. It is deplorable, but it is also unfortunately true that this element asserts itself more easily and more frequently than the good. The historical perversity of human nature, its constant inclination to do wrong, too often discourages the philanthropist. Philosophy does not regard this problem with indifference, as the London Times reviewer of the wisdom of the over-self alleged, but rather with seriousness. Nothing that was written in that book was intended to deny the horrible actuality of evil, the constant activity of evil, its terrible havoc in human history and its frightful reality in human lives. That humanity should be allowed to fall into its horrible depths seems to show a lack of goodness in the divine idea of the world. Men are not to be blamed for questioning the divine goodness and doubting the divine wisdom. They often ask themselves the question, why does the higher power, which they call God and is in scientific actuality the world mind, which is so universally regarded as beneficent, even permit these evils and horrors to threaten humanity? But they ought also to ask themselves the further question whether the world idea could have completely fulfilled its lofty purpose for humanity without permitting such experiences. If it seeks to bring every human entity to full moral, intellectual and spiritual self-consciousness, the range of experiences within which the entity would have to be free to travel, would have to be sufficiently wide, and consequently sufficiently contrasting, to achieve this goal. To have limited this range to the non-evil, to have restricted the kinds of experience only to what we know as the good, would have rendered impossible the full achievement of human self-consciousness. That, after all, is a matter not only of morality but also of knowledge. There is indeed no other way than the existing one in which humanity could have found all the conditions necessary for the development of all its faculties. The mere fact that the world mind suffers evil to exist should show that it has a temporary, an inevitable or else a utilitarian place in the economy of things. No mode of conscious life could have been devised which provided unalloyed happiness and unmixed goodness at the same time that it provided the varied experiences and diverse states necessary to develop the knowledge, intelligence, character and spirituality of the human being. Although some facets of this development could have been obtained by a one-sided monotonous experience, yielding only the pleasurable enjoyment of life, important parts of the psyche would then necessarily have been left untouched by it. Only by providing a course of changing experiences which took a wider, more varied route and also included the opposites of suffering and evil, could the full, complete evolution of man have been achieved. The memory of the past darkness of ignorance heightens his appreciation of the present light of knowledge. The vivid contrast between the two conditions makes him much more conscious of the meaning and value of the higher one. Without the experiences of both to complement each other, he could not distinguish good from evil, bliss from misery, reality from appearance and truth from falsity. How, without conditions productive of sacrifice and self-denial, for instance, could the spiritual widening of his consciousness be obtained? Good becomes significant to him only as it stands in contrast to evil, which is indeed the not good. The consciousness of sound as sound always needs to be accompanied by the consciousness of its opposite and differentiating number, silence. There could have been no manifestation of a universe without this play of opposites running completely through it. As soon as the one became two, it began. Hence birth and death appear everywhere in the universe, pleasure and pain in man. Heraclitus of Ephesus shrewdly commented that Homer was wrong in saying, "Would that strife might perish from among gods and men," that he did not see he was really praying for the destruction of the universe and that if his prayer were answered all things would have to pass away. Every biological scientist who has peered beneath the surface of things knows, what every metaphysician should know, that the world processes inescapably an interplay and interstruggle of the creative and destructive forces. The cosmos could not be continually alive if it were not also continually dying. The struggle of these opposing forces is an eternal movement which is reflected in the birth of majestic stars and the death of minute cells. Only a static, motionless universe could have avoided it. If man were not to be a mechanical robot, he had to be free in his will, within the limits imposed by his nature and by the universal purpose. He had to be given the power to choose. And if he were left free to choose good, he had necessarily to be left free to choose evil. That he would act wrongly, would clash with his fellow men, and would even match his foolishness against God's wisdom was foreknown from the very beginning, was indeed inevitable from the fact that he began his conscious life in ignorance and desire. Through experience he would eventually learn to act rightly, and this dark phase in his career would disappear. Only by the experiment with evil could the value of good be adequately realized. God has given man enough freedom to work out his own destiny, and since there is both good and evil mixed into his nature, when the evil becomes great in volume and massive in strength, it inevitably leads to consequences such as those which menace him today. Yet this cannot be a sole and sufficient explanation of his present situation. Since his freedom of will cannot operate within a vacuum, there must be other forces at work within his environment modifying it, influencing it, and even ultimately directing it. There must be some sort of rough pattern in the universe within which his own activities must eventually fit. Unless we find some glimmering of this pattern, we shall not be able to understand sufficiently why so many millions of apparently good, decent people should be exposed to distress and affliction resulting from the evil activities of other men. Nay, why even civilization itself should be so darkly threatened by such activities. That man's own free will has created so much of the evils and misery in the world, is obvious. That with his own moral improvement this deplorable situation would itself improve is equally obvious. But the situation itself could not have arisen except by the permission and within the conception of the world mind. Where is the more than partial freedom for a man when, at the very beginning, he is forced to accept and given no chance to select a certain race, a certain country, a particular family, a particular economic status, a condition of health or ill health, and in abundance or lack of energy, intellect, will and intuition. Thus, much of the course and something of the end of his life is dictated by nature, fate or God. No human entity can determine its own course with complete freedom. No human entity can deviate from the cosmic plan with complete independence. The freedom of all human entities is limited, as their power is dependent. Man has never possessed, does not now possess, and never can possess absolute free will. Above his own fluctuating will there is the inexorable cosmic will. All his individual development is but part of, and controlled by, the evolutionary plan for the cosmos itself. It has not been left to his internal whim or external chance what the outcome of that development shall be. If the whole cosmos is an emanation of the divine mind which, although mysteriously transcendent, is also significantly immanent, there can be no force and no entity within it that is not fundamentally rooted in the beneficence, the wisdom and the serenity of divinity. It may have its origins obscured, it may appear, think and act evilly, but it can do so only by the permission and consent of God. Therefore, it is not only man's ignorant and wrongful use of his free will that accounts for human evil and human suffering, but also the cosmic idea itself. And this is something outside his control and beyond the operation of his will. The wrongs and pain that shadow his existence were sanctioned and included in the method of his inner development. This is God's world, it could not be anyone else's. It must ultimately be an expression of God's wisdom. Therefore, if we find in it things and people, events and sights which offend us because they are diabolic rather than godlike, the reaction of instinctive repugnance is human enough, but the shortcoming is in our faculty of vision, the unpleasantness is in our limitation of the understanding, and can be nowhere else. Everywhere there are signs that the divine power is working in the midst of us. But eyes that are not spiritually opened naturally fail to see them. We would do better to complain at the presence of our own blindness than at the absence of God's activity. What we see in the world's present state and past history depends on what we are in ourselves. If we are morally crooked, we shall regard most of the people we meet as being so too. If we can find no deeper meaning in our own nature, no higher purpose in our own lives, we shall see none in the world outside. The discovery of a divine self in our own heart will be a pointing finger to the presence of a divine mind behind the whole universe to which we belong. As the human entity evolves in knowledge and consciousness, it changes its view as to what is or is not evil, just as it changes its view as to what is or is not desirable. As it sets the different pieces of the mosaic world pattern more and more into place so that the whole becomes more and more significant, as it first controls and later divests itself of the negative personal emotions, as it develops a calm impersonal interior life, its own attitude towards the ills of life changes. The change is slowly and reluctantly made, but in the end the entity is unable to resist making it. For to the extent that it deserts the ego's littleness and responds to the higher self's leading in other matters, so must it respond here. Its highest change results from the discovery of its divine self, when this relativity of evil becomes perfectly plain and the evanescence of the ego against the background of eternity becomes perfectly visible. If, from the highest possible point of view only, evil is an illusion, and if good is the opposite of evil, surely must not good itself then be an illusion also, it will be asked. The answer is that there are two goods. There is a relative one which is evil's true opposite, and illusory. There is an absolute one which is a quality of the one infinite life power, this is real good. Evil has no endlessly real existence in itself. In our ordinary human life, we find this statement contradicted. With our ordinary human mentality we find it incredible. An almost Tibetan solitude of living is needed to make it acceptable. What we have to learn, even though it is so hard to accept, is that the divine thought of the universe is not only perfect and good in its first as in its last stages, but also in its present stage. If we find the world in a mess of tragedy and suffering, of chaos and sin, the mess is really in our own sight, our own way of looking at things. If it is hard to comprehend this statement, it will be helpful to gain such comprehension by comparing humanity's experience of evil's reality with a sleeper's experience of a nightmare. The hideous or hateful figures that he sees therein are unquestionably present to him, the torments and terrors which it causes are very real to him. Yet after he wakes up, all these are seen for what they are worth, are recognized as now being what they even then were, merely ideas. On the immediate practical view it is quite true that evil is a real, widespread, powerful but limited factor in human existence. Nevertheless on the ultimate philosophic view it is not what it seems to be. It certainly exists. But such existence is relative to the human body with its finite thinking. Its presence is not to be denied, but at the same time there is a higher factor behind it as there is a higher factor behind the human body. Both evil and suffering have been allotted roles in human development from its very start. They have not appeared by accident or by any unexpected fall. They have not been introduced against the divine will by some satanic power. The fall into sin and the experience of pain are integral parts of the cosmic idea. They are not cosmic accidents or cosmic mistakes. The divine wisdom is as much at work in them as anywhere else. What is at fault is human perception, human impatience and human limitation. It is his quality and degree of consciousness which makes one man perceive only evil where another man perceives both evil and good, as well as comprehends that human evil is both the consequence of human free will and the cost of human evolution. It is difficult to defend the cruelties of nature. The destruction which happens in the teeming animal kingdom and which rouses no attention, far outweighs the destruction which happens in the human kingdom during a world war, which rouses everyone's attention. But the birth of living forms on our own plane has to be followed by their death on that plane. Those two poles in nature, the positive and negative, are an inevitable corollary of the cosmic manifestation. If the intellect can justify the cruelties of nature only by divorcing itself from all the finer emotions, let us remember that it deals with the physical level alone. The intuition, operative on a different level, finds that behind all outer forms there is the inner spirit of nature, and that a living and loving presence lies beyond the thought of man. Where the intellect becomes bitter with nature, the intuition remains sweet and serene. It concludes, and can only conclude, that if there is such goodness at the hidden heart of nature, there must be some good purpose on the surface of things. All seeming wrongs and apparent ills must have a rational place in the cosmic order, the sufferings as well as the joys. The order is not the less divinely controlled because of their existence. They are not the result of an accident in the universal functioning or of a mistake in the divine planning. The cosmos is grasped as a single whole in the infinite consciousness of the world mind. The latter, in its infinite knowledge, has foreseen all probable causes and possible consequences of human conduct. But it also knows that a corrupt humanity today will be an ennobled humanity in a far-off tomorrow. We would be justified in denouncing the divine thought as entirely wicked and absolutely merciless if the end of human existence were like this present passing phase of it, or if it were an uncertain risky gamble. But the end is glorious, its accomplishment a certainty, the process a worthwhile one. For it is a genuine unfoldment from within of attributes, capacities and states of consciousness which reflect something of the divine. If there is but a single supreme principle of being in the cosmos, if all things and all creatures have emanated from it, then what in the workings of this cosmos we call evil as well as what we call suffering must also have ultimately emanated from it. But this supreme principle being the only ever-existing one, it follows that evil and suffering in individuals are only transient appearances doomed to live fitfully and then vanish altogether. There is no pain, evil or sorrow in the eternal essence of things itself, in the absolute unity of life, as Mary Baker Eddy rightly noted. Only when the time processes of manifestation appear and only when innumerable beings are differentiated out, does their existence become even possible. For only then does the duality of opposites start. Nothing can be brought into actuality without necessarily bringing in the possibility of its contrary also. We can form the idea of light only by forming the idea of darkness along with it. If light makes darkness possible, love makes hate, joy makes pain and good makes evil possible. When the manifested beings are permitted to possess desire and to exercise will as they must be if they are not to be robots, so then potential strife for selfish ends is inevitably permitted too. There will always be evil at some point or other in the manifested cosmos because there will always be a shadow in the sunlight. No sun, no shadow, no good, no evil. These things are presupposed and negatively present in their opposites. We cannot have a manifested cosmos without having also this perpetual relationship between them. But because change is imprinted upon manifestation, it is never the same evil that we see but only a new embodiment thereof. Its old forms are transmuted by time and evolution into good. Thus, in spite of themselves, apparent evil may be productive of a change for actual good, and temporary suffering may eventually result in stable happiness. The obstructionist principle, the adverse force, the dead weight of inertia against which every effort of man to uplift himself has to contend is there because resistance to it affords the chance to develop the good. The struggle to which he is called against the resisting elements, however long drawn this struggle may be, leads to his progress. It is one allotted task of the so-called evil forces to try his mettle by hindering his growth, to test his character by tempting his desires, and to expose him for what he really is by opposing his efforts in self-development. What is this opposing power, this adverse force in the end but the personal ego in man, the lesser and lower part of himself with correspondences in the outside but unseen world? Its presence in his life provokes him into either overcoming it or yielding to it. If the first, it has led him to work for his own improvement; if the second, it has led him to acknowledge his own weakness. Sooner or later, the unpleasant consequences of such weakness will lead him to grapple with it and develop his power of will. That is part of the mission of evil, to stimulate him into its own destruction and to force him into his own betterment. Immediately and directly, it may either strengthen him or weaken him. Ultimately, it can only strengthen him. So far as human evil is concerned, it is useless to talk of the supreme power being omnipotent and therefore being able to abolish such evil at a stroke.